So who was Martin Bormann? Born in 1900, he had served in the artillery at the tail end of World War I, leaving the army in 1919. An estate manager during the Weimar Republic period, he joined a paramilitary Freikorps unit of disgruntled right-wing soldiers. An accomplice to a political murder in 1924, Bormann served a year in prison. Released in 1925, he went on to join the Nazi Party 2 years later, becoming a regional press officer and later working in the SA Brownshirts insurance office in Munich. He gained a reputation as a financial expert, becoming a powerful figure in the control of party finances. After Hitler came to power in 1933, Bormann was appointed chief of staff to Deputy Führer Rudolf Hess and given the rank of Reichsleiter, the highest political rank in the NSDAP. From 1934 onwards, Bormann was a member of Hitler's inner circle, accompanying the Führer everywhere, making himself indispensable. Bormann oversaw the renovations of Hitler's private home, the Berghof, and the process of buying up adjacent properties to create a private Nazi leader's gated community atop Obersalzberg. Bormann also had the Eagle's Nest built as a gift for Hitler's 1939 birthday. He became, in effect, Hitler's private secretary, also responsible for Hitler's private finances and collecting royalties from his book Mein Kampf, which ran into many millions of marks. Using his position as chief of staff to Hess to give him access to personnel files, Bormann was able to influence Hitler regarding important appointments. Hitler deliberately played the Nazi leaders off against each other to prevent a challenge to his authority, and Bormann was increasingly able to control who accessed the Führer, becoming Hitler's gatekeeper. The flight of Hess to Scotland in 1941 helped Bormann enormously. Hitler promoted him to become Minister Without Portfolio in the government. Bormann also earned a nickname behind his back due to the colour of his Nazi Party uniform of the Brown Eminence. During the war, Hitler was busy at his headquarters dealing with military matters, and Bormann effectively ran the nation's civilian bureaucracy for him. In this, he was deeply involved in the extension of anti-Semitic measures to the conquered Eastern territories, sharing this responsibility with Reichsfuhrer SS Heinrich Himmler. He and Himmler were also responsible for the creation and raising of the Volkssturm, Germany's last-ditch militia of old men and young boys, to try and help the regular armed forces stop the Allied advances into Germany in 1944-45. So wherever Hitler was, so was Martin Bormann. As the war situation deteriorated, Bormann's power steadily increased, and his power within the inner circle of Hitler's loyalists became immense, until by early 1945 he was effectively, as I mentioned, the gatekeeper through which everyone had to pass to see the Führer. When Hitler transferred his military headquarters to Berlin from the Adlerhorst, his last Western Front headquarters, on the 16th of January 1945, Bormann and his staff moved with him aboard the Führersonderzug, Hitler's personal train. Hitler continued to sleep and eat in the Reich Chancellery until incessant Allied air raids forced him to begin sleeping in the Führer bunker beneath the Reich Chancellery garden in mid-February 1945. In mid-March, he gave up using his office and the new Reich Chancellery for military conferences and retreated to his bunker full-time. Bormann maintained his own party chancellery apparatus and office nearby. But as Hitler's gatekeeper, Bormann himself took over a small office in the lower bunker opposite Hitler's suite of rooms, while continuing to sleep in his own bunker accommodation close by. Albert Speer, Hitler's armaments minister, noted how much of a hold Bormann had over Hitler since 1942. Quote, "After any conference with Hitler, it sometimes happened that the adjutant would announce Bormann, who had come into the room carrying his files. He spoke monotonously and with seeming objectivity, and would then advance his own solutions. On the basis of one word, agreed, or on the basis of a vague comment from Hitler, Bormann would then draft lengthy instructions, In this way, some very important decisions were taken. End quote. Bormann was, of course, greatly feared because he could change whispers into death sentences by telling tales to Hitler. Hitler even signed blank sheets of paper onto which Bormann had typed orders and directives later on. The other Nazi leaders feared Bormann, even Himmler, head of the SS, and he handled Bormann with kid gloves and carefully maintained his own very close relationship with Hitler, who trusted him completely. Bormann was never removed from power because, though the other leaders feared and despised him, they also spent most of their time vying with each other for Hitler's favour, so precluding a united stand from developing against the sinister Bormann. Bormann spent the last weeks of the war keeping Hitler busy with paperwork and administration, in this way limiting his contacts with the outside players. In this, he was ably assisted by Labour Front leader Robert Ley and the one-eyed Dr. Hans Lammers, head of the Reich Chancellery. As the Soviets surrounded Berlin and began to fight towards the city centre, Bormann had prepared plans to save Hitler and himself. As I outlined in a previous video, Bormann had put in place an evacuation scheme codenamed Operation Seraglio to move Hitler and his seat of government from besieged Berlin by a fleet of transport aircraft to the Obersalzberg to continue the war from the Bavarian Alps. Hitler resisted deserting Berlin, but many personnel and records were flown south in a series of flights from the 20th of April 1945 onwards, Hitler's last birthday. 10 aircraft loads of people and papers got away successfully, while a last plane carrying Hitler's personal papers was shot down in eastern Germany on the 21st of April, Hitler being greatly upset by the loss of these records. The problem for Bormann was that his entire power rested on being beside Hitler. Without Hitler's protection, Bormann would have been rubbed out by Himmler or some other top leader. So, though records clearly indicate that a plane was kept standing by outside Berlin to fly into the city to bring out Hitler and his staff, the passenger manifest listing Bormann among those due to be on board, Hitler dithered for days about leaving Berlin, until by the time he announced that he would die in the capital, most of the airfields had been captured by the Soviets, and the only way out by air would have been a very risky flight from a light aircraft from the temporary airstrip created on the east-west axis in the Tiergarten Park. Bormann couldn't desert Hitler while there was still a possibility that the Führer would decide to leave Berlin, so he stuck at his post and through his intrigues managed to orchestrate the dismissals of Hermann Göring and Heinrich Himmler. Göring, who had fled Berlin for Bavaria on the 20th of April 1945, unwisely attempted to succeed a still living Hitler on the 23rd of April, when news arrived that Hitler had suffered a nervous collapse following a very stressful military conference the day before, during which he had announced that the war was lost and he would die in Berlin. Bormann managed to spin Göring's moves into treason, and Hitler ordered the Reichsmarschall arrested and stripped of all his officers of state. On the 28th of April, Bormann received reports that Himmler had been secretly negotiating with the Western Allies to surrender Germany. Hitler went berserk and ordered Himmler's arrest, and Bormann gleefully transmitted orders to Grand Admiral Karl Dönitz, military commander in northern Germany, for Himmler's arrest. In the event, Dönitz ignored Bormann's orders, and Himmler would hang around Dönitz's headquarters for several days before the events that led to his mysterious demise at the hands of the British in late May 1945 began. But though Bormann took evident pleasure in eradicating his greatest competitors in Hitler's inner circle, plenty of evidence shows that in private Bormann was drinking heavily and was increasingly stressed and worried by how close the Red Army was getting to the bunker. He also championed several pointless military operations designed to relieve Berlin by weak German forces that all came to nothing. On the evening of the 28th of April 1945, the day that Himmler was ousted, Bormann sent a message to Grand Admiral Dönitz that stated, quote, Reich Chancellery a heap of rubble, end quote. The end was now very near. That same evening it was reported to Hitler that General Walter Wenck's 12th Army had failed to penetrate the Soviet ring around Berlin and relieve the beleaguered Führer and his circle. The inevitable end of the defense of the government quarter now depended on how much ammunition and willpower remained among the mostly SS troops still holding out fiercely. The last air escape from Berlin also took place that night, when test pilot Hannah Reich flew the new commanding officer of the Luftwaffe, Field Marshal Robert Ritter von Greim, out of the Tiergarten emergency airstrip in an Arado 96 training aircraft. No evidence has ever emerged since 1945 that any other German aircraft left the city centre after the 28th of April. This discredits wild conspiracies, claiming that Hitler and perhaps Bormann escaped by light plane at the last moment. The only way out of the capital now was on foot, by attempting to infiltrate through the Soviet lines. Not a very enticing prospect for middle-aged, out-of-shape leaders like Martin Bormann to contemplate. The remaining 2 days of Hitler's life are well known from the testimony of bunker survivors. In the very early hours of the 29th of April, he married his girlfriend Eva Braun in a simple ceremony in the Führerbunker. The two witnesses were Dr. Goebbels and Bormann. Hitler then dictated his political and private wills to his secretary Traudl Junger. These documents were witnessed by Goebbels, Bormann, and the two army generals, Wilhelm Burgdorf and Hans Krebs. Hitler retired to bed at 4 a.m. On the morning of the 30th of April, Hitler was informed that the units holding the government quarter would be out of ammunition in 2 days. But in the afternoon, the government quarter commanding officer, SS Brigadeführer Wilhelm Mohnke, reviewed this estimate, Hitler being told that resistance would fold by that night. General Weidling, Berlin battle commandant, asked Hitler for permission for the remaining defense forces to break out to save themselves. At 1 p.m., Hitler gave his permission. It was clear that Hitler would shortly commit suicide. Bormann remained loyally at his master's side, but then again, he had no means of escape. But we can be sure that a man like Bormann would not have intended to kill himself. He was a natural survivor, a cunning and careful man who would use what remained of his authority and power to somehow survive. So what evidence is there that Bormann intended to survive Hitler's demise? Well, on the 5th of April 1945, he had written to his wife, confirming that a senior Nazi official was arranging for her safe passage, along with his 10 children, to a place of refuge in Bavaria. On the 24th of April, Bormann sent an order from the Führerbunker, finalizing preparations for 2 huts on the eastern side of the Hohe Göll mountain near Berchtesgaden to be stocked with provisions to receive a group of people on the run. On the 29th of April, Bormann telephoned his wife, confirming the arrangements he had made and that he would be in contact with her as soon as possible. These are not the actions of a man about to kill himself. Anyway, at about 3:30 p.m. on the afternoon of the 30th of April, Hitler and his wife committed suicide in Hitler's sitting room. Much debate and intrigue surrounds the details of Hitler's death, which will be dealt with in a later series of videos. Suffice it to say, a dead Hitler and Eva were carried from the lower bunker study up the emergency exit staircase to the Reich Chancery Garden, placed in a shell hole, doused in petrol and set alight. One thing further demonstrated that Hitler was definitely dead before the breakout attempts of the night of the 1st of May 1945. The escape groups that were organized were all too small to have successfully protected and escorted Hitler. A man who was having difficulty walking or standing for long periods of time and was suffering from an undiagnosed shaking syndrome as well as several other medical maladies. Hitler could never have walked out of Berlin unassisted. The approximately 780 SS troops and bodyguards that guarded the Reich Chancery in those final hours were too few to be able to fight their way through the Soviet rings en masse. They would instead attempt to break out in small groups, less likely to attract too much attention. It is also a fact that Brigadeführer Mohnke, who commanded the bunker breakout operation, had little idea of the current dispositions of Red Army units around the government quarter as communications broke down with German defenders as they were killed or overrun. SS Brigadeführer Wilhelm Mohnke, commanding the forces defending the Reich Chancery area, had organized 10 escape groups, Martin Bormann being in group number 3. So where were the escape groups heading? What was the route out of the Soviet encirclement of the city? Moncker decided that the key to getting through was to travel largely underground, using the U-Bahn railway tunnels, where thousands of civilians had already taken shelter, and which the Soviets were very wary of entering at this time. The direction would be northwest, under the river Spree, and into the working-class district of Wedding, and thence to a rendezvous in a wooded area near Schwerin, north of the Elbe River, 80 miles northwest of Berlin. From there, Moncker's plan was to continue on to German-held territory in the north and Grand Admiral Dönitz's headquarters in Schleswig-Holstein. Moncker and Bormann carried the original Hitler documents, his last will and testament that had to be hand-delivered to Dönitz, as well as a protocol drawn up by Reich Chancellor Goebbels before his suicide earlier in the day. A final message sent to Dönitz seems to confirm Moncker's plan and Bormann's part in it. At 2:46 p.m. on the 1st of May 1945, Goebbels had sent a message to Dönitz informing him of Hitler's death the day before and his appointment as Reich President. One line in Goebbels' message reads, quote, "Reichsleiter Bormann intends to go to you today and to inform you of the situation," end quote. So this is the motive for Bormann's attempts to escape the bunker in a breakout group that same night. He still had a role to play in the Nazi government, and he intended to go to Dönitz and take his place within that last Nazi government that still controlled some of northern Germany, all of Denmark and Norway, and half of the Netherlands. Returning to the actual breakout, it had been decided that they would depart between 10:30 and 11 p.m., using darkness as cover. Most of the escapers wore military uniforms. They largely abandoned any fancy party uniforms and armbands for plain SS or Wehrmacht field grey, steel helmets, and plenty of small arms. Witnesses report that Bormann was dressed in either his brown party uniform without insignia, which seems very foolish, or his SS Obergruppenführer's field grey uniform, Bormann being an honorary SS general, or even in civilian clothing, as some members of the escape groups were wearing. There are several immediate problems with this. Firstly, how could so many witnesses, all of whom had known Bormann every day for weeks, months, or even years, not been consistent regarding how he was dressed from the breakout? It can be explained in a variety of ways. People were looking only to their own survival. They were under considerable stress, or they were recalling the events in retrospect and mixing up how they recalled Bormann dressing in the days preceding the breakout. Secondly, it makes no sense for a man like Bormann, who was the senior surviving Nazi leader in Berlin on the 1st of May 1945, to attempt to make a very dangerous evasion through an active battlefield dressed in either of his usual uniforms. The brown NSDAP uniform would have simply marked him out as a senior leader, and he may just as well have painted a giant target on his back. Wearing his SS general's uniform was likewise foolish. The chances that his escape group might have to bluff its way past Soviet patrols was high. So any uniform that drew attention to one's real status was counterproductive. Bormann was not a stupid man. He was also almost 45 years old, portly, balding, and would never have been mistaken for a frontline soldier. Some investigators mentioned that he was wearing a field grey uniform stripped of insignia, which would have been sensible, allowing him to pose as an older Volkssturm Home Guardsman, ditto with civilian clothing. Anyway, the clothing issue is just the first of many such problems with Bormann's attempt to escape Berlin. The first two escape groups followed the same route away from the bunker. Group 1, of 20 men and 4 women, led by General Moncker, included Bormann's secretary Elsa Krüger, Hitler's adjutant Sturmbannführer Günscher, and Hitler's cook and his two secretaries. Group number 3, which contained Bormann, also included Hitler's pilot, Hans Bauer, and his second pilot, Beetz, Goebbels' adjutant, SS Hauptsturmführer Gunther Schwegermann, and one of Hitler's doctors, Ludwig Stumpfegger. Group 4, behind, was supposedly led by Hitler Youth leader Arthur Axmann, but he ended up with Bormann's group. The first stage in the journey was a 100-meter dash under fire from the bunker to the Kaiserhof U-Bahn station. They made it under cover of darkness, smoke, and rubble. They then walked along the tunnel to Stadtmitte station. By the time Moncker's group reached Stadtmitte, only about 15 people remained, the rest having made themselves scarce. At Stadtmitte station, U-Bahn carriages were being used as an emergency operating theatre. Moncker's group, allegedly, was forced to surface at Friedrichstrasse station due to the tunnel beyond being sealed by a huge metal bulkhead, guarded by two railway employees who refused to open it. We are to believe that Moncker's heavily armed group of desperate SS and party officials argued futilely with the railway guards and meekly gave up and went up to the street, which was an active battle zone. Seems a bit unlikely. It was noted by other escapers that this barrier was open an hour later. As for Bormann's group, they missed an important turn in the tunnel, halfway between Stadtmitte and Friedrichstrasse stations. They backtracked to Stadtmitte and decided to come up to street level at the Gendarmenmarkt, opposite the Max Reinhardt Theatre. But progress was clearly too dangerous. Descending back into the station, they tried to get to Friedrichstrasse again moving above ground. At the Weitendamm Bridge, they discovered that their way forward was blocked by a tank barrier. Here things become very confused. Apparently, a Tiger tank or tanks was active at the bridge, part of the SS Nordland division, and had made an attempt to force their way across under heavy Soviet fire to clear a path for many German troops and civilians trying to escape behind them. Many testimonies claim that Bormann was actually riding in a Tiger tank that was hit by a captured German Panzerfaust rocket launcher and destroyed. This story was first published in English by respected British historian and World War II intelligence officer Major Hugh Trevor Roper in his seminal work, The Last Days of Hitler, first published in 1953. His main witness appears to have been Erich Kempke, Hitler's chauffeur, who ran the Reich Chancery garage. In his book, I Burned Adolf Hitler, published in 1950, Kempke said that he saw Bormann riding in the tank that was seconds later totally destroyed by the anti-tank weapon. Kempke was sure that Bormann was killed. Kempke managed to make it to freedom at the Elbe River, where he was arrested by the US Army. The major problems with the Kempke story are obvious. Firstly, if Bormann was riding in the Tiger tank, Kempke could not have seen him in battle conditions. The tank would have had all hatches closed and locked. Secondly, there is no space aboard a Tiger for passengers. The only way Bormann could have been inside the tank was if a crewman gave up his seat. Considering that the tank was seen fighting its way over the bridge, presumably Bormann had taken a secret Panzer gunnery course so he could replace the gunner or loader in the Tiger's turret. The biggest howler is even placing Bormann in a tank in the first place. A huge Tiger would have been the focus of Soviet fire and been lashed with anti-tank shells, captured Panzerfausts, machine gun and rifle fire, with its immobilization or destruction a distinct possibility. So what about the Tiger tank or tanks in question? SS Gruppenführer Gustav Krukenberg, who was commanding the Nordland division in the area, gave testimony that five of his tanks were ordered by him to smash their way through the Weitendamm Bridge barrier at 2 a.m. on the 2nd of May 1945, and that they successfully pushed on further up the Friedrichstrasse, engaging Soviet forces. Krukenberg had no knowledge of Bormann in or on one of his tanks, and there were no other German tanks in the vicinity. However, other German witnesses gave different versions of the Bormann Tiger tank story. Hitler's pilot, Hans Bauer, was later captured by the Soviets and spent years in Moscow being brutally interrogated regarding Hitler's whereabouts and fate. Bauer claimed to Trevor Roper, after he had returned from captivity, that Bormann had definitely been killed when the Tiger tank had exploded. A story also confirmed by SS Major Heinz Linger, Hitler's valet, who also was captured by the Red Army and held for 10 years. But after Bauer had started discussing things with Arthur Axmann, the Hitler Youth leader who joined Bormann's group from the group behind, and who ultimately successfully escaped from Berlin and was later apprehended by the Americans in Bavaria, Bauer's story changed in the late 1950s. Bauer now claimed that Bormann had not been killed by the tank explosion, and that he had even accompanied Bormann further along the escape route. Historians subsequently altered Bauer's testimony to fit Axmann's story, who became the Allied star witness to the events surrounding Bormann's disappearance. Bauer claimed that Bormann had gone ahead, but that he, Bauer, had caught up with him sitting on the stone steps of a bombed-out house. The location Bauer gave was the corner of Schiffbauerdamm and Friedrichstrasse, on the Soviet side of the Weidendamm Bridge. Bauer, Axmann and Goebbels' adjutant Gunter Schwegermann said that the remainder of Group 3 moved along the Schiffbauerdamm towards the Lehrter railway station. A very dangerous route that would have taken them past the Reichstag, which was surrounded by Soviet troops at the time. Bauer had actually been wounded in both legs as he tried to clamber down onto the road from the railway bridge over the Humboldt Harbour. Bauer stated that he last saw Bormann when the group was opposite the Reichstag, standing on the Lehrter railway tracks half a mile from the station. He reported that Bormann and Dr. Stumpfegger broke away from the group and walked east along Invalidenstrasse towards the Stettiner station. But if Bauer was wounded before reaching this point near the Lehrter station, this testimony is also suspect. The next important piece of testimony concerning Bormann's movements came from Arthur Axmann. He claimed that during the tank battle at the Weidendamm Bridge, he had taken cover in a shell hole, finding Bormann, Werner Naumann, Gunter Schwegermann, Bauer and Stumpfegger also doing the same. Moving along the railway tracks towards the Lehrter station, Axmann claimed that as they jumped down from a bridge over the Friedrich-List-Ufer west of the Humboldt Harbour, the bridge leading to the Lehrter S-Bahn station, several of the party landed among some Soviet infantry camped beneath it. They were surrounded. The Soviets were friendly and fascinated by Axmann's artificial arm, he having lost his arm when serving as a soldier on the Eastern Front. They offered the Germans cigarettes. Clearly, they thought this group of largely middle-aged Germans, dressed in a strange variety of outfits, to be harmless Volkssturm Home Guardsmen. However, Axmann stated that Bormann and Stumpfegger moved away and then ran off shortly afterwards, the Soviets becoming suspicious. Axmann and his friend Major Gunter Veltzin did likewise. Moving east up Invalidenstrasse, Axmann claimed to have found the bodies of Bormann and Stumpfegger lying behind the bridge where Invalidenstrasse crosses the railway line. The Lehrter station and the surrounding bridges have all been knocked down and rebuilt in 2005-6, and all of the original buildings to do with the Bormann escape have now been destroyed. Axmann described how Bormann and Stumpfegger were both lying on their backs, apparently dead, but with no visible wounds in the moonlight. He was apparently certain that both men had killed themselves with poison. Neither he nor Major Veltzin took their pulses, and they quickly moved on. The problem with this story is the timeline. Axmann and historians who have repeated these claims all agree that the touching scene occurred between 1:30 and 2 a.m., whereas multiple testimonies claim that the tank battle at the Weidendamm Bridge occurred at about 2:30 a.m. It doesn't make sense. Axmann's testimony was obviously wrong. Other writers have pointed out that Axmann behaved strangely when he allegedly discovered Bormann's body. Axmann knew that Bormann was in possession of Hitler's last will and testament and other very important documents, yet he made no effort to retrieve these documents from the corpse. Another big problem for the Bormann death scene was that no one else reported seeing the two bodies laying on the ground in the position reported by Axmann. They simply weren't there. They disappeared into thin air. Following Axmann's alleged sighting of the two bodies, Martin Bormann was not seen in Berlin again until 1972, when his skull was found under rather fishy circumstances close to where Axmann said he had last seen the body. Was Bormann seen alive after 1945, and where? We left episode 2 with Martin Bormann and his companion, SS Dr. Ludwig Stumpfegger, lying apparently dead on an overpass bridge connected to the Lehrter railway station in Berlin, as reported by two witnesses, Hitler Youth leader Arthur Axmann and his escape companion, Army Major Gunter Veltzin. Only Axmann would ultimately survive to explain to historians the apparent circumstances of Bormann's death. If you recall, Axmann told the Americans in about 1947 that Bormann and Stumpfegger lay dead, their faces clearly identifiable in the moonlight of the early morning hours of the 2nd of May 1945, lying on the bridge over the Invalidenstrasse. Neither man had any obvious wounds, and Axmann asserted that they both must have taken poison. Axmann did not examine the bodies closely, and he crucially did not search Bormann for the original copies of Hitler's last will and testament that the Reichsminister was conveying to Grand Admiral Dönitz in the north of Germany, who was the new Reich President, even though he knew Bormann had these documents and that they were needed urgently in the north. After this touching scene, the Bormann trail goes dead in Berlin. But was Bormann ever seen and identified after the war? Many of you are undoubtedly aware that in 1972, Bormann's skull was recovered close to where Axmann said he had seen him dead, and that modern DNA tests have proved beyond any reasonable doubt that it is Bormann's. What I'm going to show you later is many of the glaring inconsistencies that exist in the official West German story of the remains discovery, and how forensic examination of the skull actually showed up several problematic pieces of evidence suggesting that Bormann was alive after 1945, and far from where his skull was conveniently discovered in 1972. Certainly, the Western Allies believe that Bormann escaped from Berlin in May 1945. Soviet historians also allege that Bormann had been arranging his future safe passage, and possibly that of his wife Gerda and their 10 children, via his economic adviser, Dr. Helmut von Hummel. Letters from Bormann to his wife, dated the 5th of April 1945, confirm his use of von Hummel, who was head of Group 3B of the Department of Economic and Social Affairs. It was von Hummel who was talked into setting up the 2 huts on the east side of the Hoher Goll mountain near Berchtesgaden that I mentioned in the first episode, the idea being perhaps that they could be used by a single person or a group on the run heading south. This order was made by Bormann on the 24th of April 1945. It is alleged that when Bormann last spoke on the telephone to his wife on the 29th of April, he told her to place herself in von Hummel's care and that he would be in contact as soon as possible. Soviet historian Lev Bezeminsky, using official Soviet files, alleged that Bormann crossed into Italy on the 16th of August 1947, but no further details were revealed. When Bezeminsky spoke to von Hummel, the German was evasive and said that Bormann's reference to make a, quote, southward overseas shipment, end quote, in the cable he sent to von Hummel referred simply to moving documents south to safety in Munich and not to moving Bormann. The United States Army's Counterintelligence Corps, the direct ancestor of the CIA, thought that Bormann was alive in 1945, and they posted agents around Frau Bormann, who was dying of cancer in a hospital in Murano in the Italian Alps, hoping Bormann might show up. Gerda Bormann died on the 22nd of March 1946 without further contact with her husband. The Soviets did mention that they had found Bormann's diary in the leather coat of a German corpse in central Berlin, the body laying close to a knocked-out German tank. The Soviets stated that neither the body nor the coat were Bormann's. They surmised that Bormann had stuffed the diary into the coat in order to appear dead to investigators, a sensible move for a man on the run. By the way, one really big thing in Bormann's favour was his anonymity. Hardly anyone outside of Hitler's inner circle knew who he was. He never spoke publicly, and all his appearances were as a background character. This fact would aid his evasion enormously, unlike someone like Heinrich Himmler, who was distinctive and world-famous. Several witnesses placed Bormann in northern Germany or Denmark in June 1945. The author Ladislas Farrago found a Danish doctor called Preuss, who claimed to have been approached by a Nazi friend asking for money to get Bormann out of Denmark. Bormann was next sighted in September 1945 in the Via Leonardo da Vinci in Murano, Italy, by someone who knew him extremely well, a Frau Thalheimer, the wife of one of his personal doctors, whom he knew socially. The Doctor's Wife's story so convinced Hugh Trevor Roper, the famous British historian and World War II intelligence officer, that Uxmann's story of a dead Bormann on the Leiter Bridge must be unconvincing. So why would Bormann be in northern Italy? Rat lines, secret Nazi escape routes, ran from Germany and Austria into Italy, whence some Vatican officials connived to spirit wanted Nazis out of Europe via the port of Genoa to South America and the Middle East. This was how several high-profile Nazis escaped in the years after World War II, including Adolf Eichmann, the administrative head of the Final Solution, an infamous Auschwitz camp doctor, Josef Mengele. They are just two cases of thousands who were helped to flee by sympathizers, by Nazi networks that were put in place before the war ended, and even by United States officials who employed wanted Nazis for intelligence reasons in the years after the war, during the early part of the Cold War, and in fact allowed many of them to escape into anonymity in South America and elsewhere, rather than admit they had been using these men who were wanted for heinous crimes committed against the Jews and many other groups. Certainly the Israelis believe that Bormann was alive and well in South America. Interestingly, during the interrogation of Adolf Eichmann following his kidnapping by Mossad agents and removal to Israel to stand trial, Eichmann told German-born Israeli police officer Captain Avner Less, who was one of his interrogators, that Bormann was alive. This was in 1961. This claim was repeated by Eichmann's son Nicholas, who told reporters, quote, Bormann is not as poor as my father was. Not even the Jews with millions of dollars can get him, end quote. Lots of claims concerning the whereabouts of Bormann and how he escaped Europe were made in the 1960s and 70s, though most were dismissed as fabrications or fantasy. But despite the nonsense that clouded the true story, an Israeli team continued to hunt him, indicating that there must have been real evidence. Otherwise, why waste the time and resources of a national intelligence agency? The team was led by none other than Dr. Friedman, who had led the operation to kidnap Adolf Eichmann. These were very serious people. It was not only the Israelis that believed Bormann was alive. Following the discovery of Dr. Werner Haider, an SS doctor and wanted war criminal, the Frankfurt State Prosecutor in West Germany, Dr. Fritz Bauer, conducted a lengthy interview with him. On the 11th of February 1964, as a result of this interview, a statement was issued which read, quote, despite allegations to the contrary, including the testimony of Hans Bauer, Hitler's pilot, the Office of the Attorney General of the State of Hesse continues to pursue its search for Martin Bormann in the factual belief that the head of the NSDAP survived. End quote. It was clear that Dr. Haider had told the West Germans some interesting things that corroborated their own investigation of Bormann. However, 2 days after the statement was issued, Dr. Haider was found hanged in his cell. What Haider had told the West Germans was that in 1945 he had hidden Bormann in the SS hospital at Grasden, near the Danish town of Sonderburg. In July 1964, State Prosecutor Bauer told the press that he had been informed that Bormann was living in Paraguay and, interestingly, had been seen in the company of Dr. Josef Mengele on several occasions in the capital city, Asuncion. By August, more details emerged. Bormann was dead. He had died in 1959 in the house of a Paraguayan German named Bernard Jung. The body had been buried at the village of Ita, 35 kilometers from Asuncion. A West German journalist went to Ita and actually dug up the grave, but the bones appeared to be those of a much older local Indian man. Bernard Jung was traced to Spain, but he refused all interview requests. Interestingly, when Franz Stangl, the death camp commandant who had been in charge of Treblinka and Sobibor at different times and was responsible for nearly 1 million deaths, was arrested in Brazil, he talked to Tagesspiegel, a German newspaper, and said that Bormann had been, quote, one of us, end quote, that is, a fugitive Nazi in South America. Lots of charlatans tried to get attention or to make money out of the Bormann story. But one of the best pieces of evidence of Bormann's survival came from a former Goebbels propaganda ministry official and honorary SS major named Dr. Johann von Leers. He fled to Argentina in the late 1940s, founding a Nazi journal in Buenos Aires in 1950. Later, he moved to Egypt, working as a political advisor for President Nasser's government, converting to Islam and taking the name Omar Amin. He died in Cairo in 1965. Some letters written by von Liers came to light. In one, he wrote to a friend that Bormann was in South America, then living in Brazil. This letter is significant because it was completely private and written years before the press coverage that surrounded the story in the late 1960s and throughout the 1970s. Journalists and historians did find several witnesses in Paraguay who claimed that Bormann had died in the city of Asunción of cancer in 1959, following treatment by Dr. Mengele and other emigre doctors, and was buried secretly at Ita. But all of this is, of course, anecdotal evidence and not concrete proof of Bormann's survival after the war. The writer Ladislas Farrago gathered a lot of evidence concerning Bormann, though some of it was tainted and turned out to have been forged by Paraguayan officials for money. However, among all the dross, there were some good pieces of circumstantial evidence for Bormann being in South America, and this, of course, is overlooked in the rubbishing of Farrago's work. Farrago claimed that Bormann crossed the Atlantic from Genoa, Italy, to Argentina aboard an Italian liner, arriving on the 17th of May 1948. Via Vatican ratline personnel, he had obtained a Red Cross passport for stateless persons. Farrago's information was that Bormann travelled under the name Elisir Goldstein, a Polish Jew born in 1901, occupation geologist. Much of Farrago's evidence was later rubbished under investigation, though some of it still stands up to scrutiny. It is interesting to note that Soviet investigators came to the same conclusion as Farrago, though independently, that Bormann had indeed escaped to South America via Italy. The Argentine government actually released its files on Martin Bormann on the 1st of February 1992. Their file had been opened on him in 1948, the same year Farrago and others alleged that he had entered Argentina by ship. The file contained all the allegations they had ever come across, including correspondence with the United States and West German governments. But they had been remarkably slow and apparently disinterested in following up all leads concerning Bormann. Interestingly, the government office books for the period 1957-60 and 1960-67 were missing, allegedly destroyed by flooding in the archive. Thus, a lot of the information from the real height of the Bormann hunt was missing. Bormann was officially declared dead by the West German government in 1973. From the circumstantial evidence presented, it is certainly possible to reconstruct a possible escape route for Martin Bormann. Beginning at the moment when he and Dr. Stumpfegger ran off from the Soviet troops who surrounded them in the early hours of the 2nd of May 1945 near the Leerta station, after his escape group had jumped down from a bridge and landed amongst a camped Soviet infantry platoon. Bormann next popped up in Schleswig-Holstein before being placed in June 1945 in the SS hospital at Sonderburg, Denmark. We know that Bormann had ordered huts to be prepared on the Hoher Göll near Berchtesgaden, so there was a possible staging area if he had chosen to go south, and he could have posed as just another middle-aged, bombed-out refugee moving around shattered Germany. He was identified in Murano, Italy in September 1945 by the wife of one of his doctors. At some point, he must have been in Rome, obtaining the necessary passport and Argentine entry visa. Next, Farrago placed Bormann, now calling himself Elisir Goldstein, disembarking from a ship in Argentina on the 16th of February 1948. And finally, we have some interesting anecdotal evidence from relatively good sources of Bormann being in Asunción, Paraguay in at least 1959, and dying in that year from cancer, aged 58 or 59. He was then buried in secret near the capital. In the next episode, we will deal with the elephant in the room, the discovery of Martin Bormann's skull in 1972 in Berlin, close to where he was said to have died in 1945. For those of you who think Hitler Youth leader Arthur Axmann was telling the truth about seeing the corpses of Bormann and Dr. Ludwig Stumpfegger on the Leerter Station Bridge, consider this information that supports the theory that Bormann didn't die exactly as reported. On the 14th of August 1945, Gertrud Stumpfegger, Dr. Stumpfegger's widow, received a letter from a man identifying himself as Bernd, the postmaster at the Leerter Station. It read, quote, "On May 8th this year, a soldier was found by employees at this post office on the railroad bridge crossing Invalidenstrasse. A military pass in his pocket identified him as Ludwig Stumpfegger. Your husband was buried together with other dead soldiers in the grounds of the Alpendorf in Berlin, Northwest 40 at 63 Invalidenstrasse," end quote. Included with the letter were personal photographs that Stumpfegger had been carrying. Postmaster Bernd noted that Stumpfegger's military pass had later been destroyed. The Stumpfegger family used Bernd's letter to obtain from a court proof of death of the doctor. 2 points are worth raising. The letter doesn't mention that Stumpfegger was found lying close next to another dead soldier, or even allude to other corpses being on the bridge. Secondly, the Bormann family did not receive a similar letter from the Leerter station personnel concerning the discovery of Bormann's corpse. The West German magazine Der Spiegel thought that this was odd and investigated further. In an article dated the 14th of February 1964, Der Spiegel noted, quote, "In actual fact, the corpse of Stumpfegger was found, but of Bormann, who was said to have been lying alongside, there was no trace," end quote. We can discount a series of claims made after the article appeared by people who claim to have helped bury Bormann's corpse and claiming that they recognized the dead man, when of course we know that very few outside of Hitler's inner circle actually knew who Martin Bormann was. Now we come to the circumstances that led to the discovery of the bones of Bormann and Stumpfegger in 1972. The crucial person was a Hitler Youth leader named Jochen von Lang, who in May 1945 had been in Axmann's escape group from the Reich Chancellery, the group Axmann had later lost to join Bormann's group that was moving in front. Von Lang dedicated many years to trying to prove that Bormann had died in Berlin on the 2nd of May 1945. In September 1962, Arthur Axmann gave evidence to Frankfurt State Prosecutor's Office lawyer Joachim Richter. Axmann knew that his original testimony was in doubt, not least by historian Hugh Trevor Roper. In 1971, Trevor Roper even said of Axmann, quote, "I do not rule out the possibility that he made up the story in the first place to cover Bormann's tracks," end quote. It is very important to note that Arthur Axmann was, until his dying day, an unreconstructed Nazi. Indeed, when he escaped to the West in 1945, he set about trying to organize an underground Nazi Party organization using his network of former Hitler Youth leaders and personnel. He didn't simply go to ground and do nothing or try to escape to South America. He made an active effort to try to keep the flame alive. And indeed, in one of my previous videos concerning Hitler's ashes, I contend that he was in fact carrying a small box containing some of Hitler's ashes from the Führerbunker, and that he later deposited those in a grave somewhere in Germany. Therefore, regarding Axmann, why would he have told the truth to American investigators? And why wouldn't he have tried to help Bormann to escape? I cannot stress any more emphatically the point that the entire story of Bormann's demise is based on one man's testimony, the devout Nazi Arthur Axmann, who several intelligence officers called the keeper of the flame of National Socialism post-1945. In any other case of a mysterious death, such a witness would long ago have been dismissed as biased and unreliable. I believe Hugh Trevor Roper called this one right in 1971 when he realized that Axmann was a liar. In 1965, a former Hitler Youth member whom Jochen von Lang had known in 1945, Herbert Seidel, contacted him with his eyewitness account. In early May 1945, Seidel, then age 14, with a friend, had been foraging for food in the Leerter station freight yard when he said that he had seen two bodies on the left side of the railway bridge crossing Invalidenstrasse. Seidel hadn't known who Bormann was, and he hadn't identified the bodies he had seen. but had placed them roughly to where Axmann reported seeing Bormann and Stumpfegger's corpses. Then another witness came forward, a retired post office worker named Albert Krumnov. In May 1945, he claimed to have been part of Postmaster Bernd's corpse burial unit at the Lehrte station. Krumnov and his post office colleagues, Wagenfuhl and Loser, had been ordered by the Red Army to bury corpses that were laying around the Lehrte station. Krumnov claimed his unit had buried on the 8th of May 1945 both bodies. Wagenfuhl had buried Stumpfegger and Krumnov himself had buried Bormann. They hadn't recognized either man at the time, and for some curious reason, they said the two bodies were buried some distance apart from each other, even though found alongside of each other on the bridge. Even more strangely, the corpse of the 6-foot-4-inch tall Stumpfegger was without its uniform, being dressed instead in new long woolen white underwear, which makes a mockery of Postmaster Bernd's claim that he retrieved Stumpfegger's military pass and family photographs from the dead soldier. Did Stumpfegger keep his papers stuffed down his underpants? The shorter man, buried by Krumnov, was dressed in a field grey army uniform without any insignia. Krumnov even claimed to have specifically chosen the burial site of the shorter man's corpse, placing it below a stand of 3 poplar trees. He said to later remember where it was. This is rather odd. Why would he have to remember where one particular corpse was buried if a man he didn't know who it was, hadn't identified it, wasn't wearing a uniform of any significance, and indeed the entire station and the surrounding area was full of corpses which they'd have been in a hurry to bury? Interestingly, Postmaster Bernd already noted Stumpfegger's burial place as the Alpendorf, Berlin, Northwest 40, number 63, Invalidenstrasse. Based upon these witnesses, the West German prosecutors that were searching for Bormann's remains became very enthusiastic, and von Lang managed to persuade them without too much difficulty to start digging for the bodies, to settle the issue of Bormann's escape once and for all. The problem was the Berlin Wall, which ran right through the site. However, the area where Axmann and Krumnov claimed to have seen Bormann's corpse was on the West Berlin side of the wall, an area called the Ulap Fairground. A search of official records at the time revealed nothing about either burial. The Ulap Fairground was located at Alpendorf, Gelände, Berlin, Northwest 40, Invalidenstrasse 63. The address today has changed, now being 63-68 Invalidenstrasse, and the entire area completely rebuilt. However, in 1965, the stand of poplar trees noted by Krumnov as the spot where he buried Bormann was still growing. In July 1965, the spot was duly excavated with journalists standing by for the scoop. They removed a large amount of Berlin yellow sandy soil, reaching a layer of ash marking the May 1945 ground level, but no Bormann was found. Von Lang, worried, wanted to dig up the entire site to find the bones of Bormann and Stumpfegger, but this didn't happen. In fact, nothing happened for another 7.5 years, until December 1972, when the authorities announced that 2 sets of bones had been accidentally uncovered by workmen digging only 13 metres from the spot where Krumnov alleged he had buried a body resembling Bormann in May 1945. But the authorities' contention that the discovery was accidental was not quite the whole truth. In summer 1972, von Lang had found out that building work was to commence on the Ulap Fairground site. Stern magazine had been alerted and the West German authorities concerning the possibility of finding Bormann's remains. In fact, many of the workmen on the site thought that they would receive a big reward if they found Bormann. So it was a hunt for Bormann that ended with an accidental discovery. Now for the weird parts of the story. Or I should say the weirder parts. The skeletons of a short man and a very tall man were found buried beside each other, the tall man's feet next to the shorter man's skull. But wait a minute. Postmaster Bernd had written to Frau Stumpfegger in 1945 without recording another body laying right next to her husband's. And if you remember, Albert Krumnov and his burial detail from the post office had interred the 2 corpses quite far apart. They specifically mentioned this. Now, in 1972, the Bormann corpse was found 15 metres from where Krumnov had noted it as being buried beneath a small stand of three poplar trees that were still growing in 1972. This is all rather strange. Dr. Stumpfegger's corpse, if we are to believe postmaster Berndt and post-worker Krumnov, had also managed to move a considerable distance following interment to lay next to Bormann's corpse, which had also shifted 15 metres from where it was buried, again rather weird. Unless, of course, we completely dismiss postmaster Berndt, post-worker Krumnov, and all the other witnesses as liars or faulty memories. But the weirdest thing was the condition of the smaller man's skull in comparison to the skeleton of Dr. Stumpfegger. The latter was identified based on a rough dental sketch from 1945 that the West Germans had in their archive. The shorter man's skull was completely encased in a reddish-brown clay. Stumpfegger's skull did not exhibit this strange coating. It looked as though Bormann's skeleton had not originally been buried in the yellow sandy soil of Berlin, but someplace else, and at some point reburied next to Stumpfegger's skeleton at the old Ulap fairground. The skull was later cleaned of this volcanic reddish-brown clay material, but such a said type is native to one area long associated with Martin Bormann, Ita in Paraguay, where, it is said, Martin Bormann was buried in 1959 after dying of cancer. Before we move on to the question of why Bormann's skull may have been planted, let us consider some of the other interesting points concerning both bodies. One of the major problems, you will note, if you look at both contemporary coverage of this story or modern retellings, is the way Bormann and Stumpfegger's skulls are repeatedly mislabeled in photographs. Stumpfegger's skull is often labelled as Bormann's. You may also note that a large portion of the left vault of Stumpfegger's skull is missing. Indeed, the skull was found in this state. The authorities claimed at the time that this damage had been caused by a steam shovel during excavation. If that was so, the skull, due to the great power of the shovel, would be cracked, radial cracks spreading from the damaged area. This is not the case. The broken bone or parts of it would have been driven into the brain cavity and should still have been present in the soil. The missing section actually shows a vertical cut edge, a pattern completely at odds with the downward force of a steam shovel. The missing skull parts give the impression of having been surgically removed, the cuts reminiscent of surgical sores. The missing parts of the skull were never found in the soil around the skeleton, despite the area being repeatedly searched. Some researchers have suggested that the skull was worked on post-mortem to conceal evidence of a gunshot wound. Remember, Arthur Axmann asserted that Bormann and Stumpfegger had killed themselves using poison. This became the official government position as well, even though Axmann was heavily doubted later on, including by such authorities as Hugh Trevor Roper. Dr. Stumpfegger's skull having a bullet hole in the left temple would have made a mockery of all the eyewitness testimony and put in doubt the story of a dead Bormann lying on the bridge. Whether Stumpfegger killed himself or was killed in the fighting that was still ongoing around the Lehrte station remains open to debate. What we can say, however, is the skull is very strange. Cyanide capsule remains were indeed found in the mouths of both skulls in 1972, but they turned out to be of a type not used by German personnel in 1945. Again, strange. Bormann was initially identified by his teeth, based on the memories of Hitler's dentist Professor Hugo Blaschke, who was captured by the Americans in 1945. Fritz Echtmann, a German dental assistant who worked for Professor Blaschke, also agreed with Blaschke's diagram of Bormann's teeth. Bormann's dentition mostly accorded to the two dental experts' recollections. Interestingly, an upper jaw dental bridge made by Fritz Echtmann for Bormann was missing from the red clay-encased skull found in 1972. Although the yellow sandy soil around the corpse was thoroughly searched repeatedly, the bridge wasn't found. Forensic odontologist Dr. Reidar Sognaes asked the West German Chancellor Willy Brandt for permission to examine the Bormann skull, as he had collected extensive data on Bormann's dentition from historical sources, and he wanted to help in the identification of the corpse. While Saugnay's request was being debated by the powers that be, Bormann's missing bridge work was suddenly found 3 months after the skull had been located, and it was found only 1 meter away from the grave, even though the site had been very thoroughly sifted many times. When Dr. Saugnay's discovered discrepancies between the skull he examined and Professor Blaschke's records, the authorities neatly explained these away by saying that Blaschke's records were wrong. But Blaschke's records were meticulous and were deemed accurate enough to enable the West German government to state that the skull was definitely Martin Bormann's, leading to him being declared legally dead in 1973. Therefore, the official story remains that Bormann died by cyanide poisoning in Berlin in the early hours of the 2nd of May 1945. So what did Dr. Saugnay's discover that is at variance with the official line? Put simply, Saugnay's found evidence of dental work on Bormann's teeth not noted by Professor Blaschke or his technician Echtmann, work using materials that could only have occurred after 1945. Basically, the state of Bormann's teeth indicated more dental problems than those noted by the thorough and professional Blaschke before May 1945. The first area to be red flagged was the two lower central incisors. On Dr. Blaschke's diagram, both teeth were natural and without fillings. On the Bormann skull, found in 1972, the teeth had been replaced by two plastic posts to support a bridge. Saugnay's couldn't understand how Blaschke could not recall fitting such a major piece of dental furniture during his treatments of Bormann. This was explained away as Blaschke's poor memory. Interestingly, another of Hitler's dental technicians, Käthe Heusermann, had, when interviewed, accurately described Bormann's teeth, producing the same pattern of dentition recalled by Blaschke and Echtmann. When Heusermann was told that Bormann had a missing lower front incisor bridge, she was in disbelief. Fritz Echtmann had made bridges for Professor Blaschke's patients, and when interviewed, he had no recollection of making one for the front of Bormann's teeth, and also contended that Professor Blaschke's diagram of Bormann's teeth was accurate. But there was more. Blaschke's diagram noted that Bormann's first upper left molar was missing, as well as the third upper right molar. But on the skull, both teeth were present and had gold crowns. This indeed is very strange. There were also several other areas of concern noted by Dr. Saugnay's, over 8 in total, that challenged the notion that Bormann had died in 1945. In fact, if you believe that Bormann died in May 1945, you must, based upon the skull's dentition, believe that Professor Blaschke was completely wrong in his recollections of the dentistry of one of his most important patients. And furthermore, you must also believe that his well-trained and skilled dental technicians, Heusermann and Echtmann, who both independently certified that Blaschke's diagram of Bormann's teeth was correct, were also both wrong, unable to recall work they had undertaken, and incompetent. That's 3 respected dental experts versus the evidence of post-1945 dental work on Bormann's skull. The Bormann skull was DNA tested in 1998 and was apparently a match for Bormann, though we don't know the absolute details of this test. The anomalies in the dental record have led many researchers to surmise that Bormann was alive after 1945. In the previous episode, I laid out the story surrounding the discovery of the skeletons of Martin Bormann and Dr. Ludwig Stumpfegger in West Berlin in 1972. And we examined in some detail the troubling forensic evidence on both men's skulls. In Stumpfegger's case, a strange excision of a portion of his skull. And in Bormann's case, evidence of post-1945 dental work suggesting, if true, that the Reichsminister had survived the war. And then there was the mysterious reddish-brown clay substance that coated Bormann's skull, but not Stumpfegger's. A kind of soil completely different from the yellow sandy soil upon which Berlin was built, but superficially identical to soil found in Ita in Paraguay, where many sources claim Martin Bormann was buried in 1959 after about 14 years on the run from justice. In this episode, I will attempt to answer the following questions. Could Bormann's skull have been planted in West Berlin in 1972, and by whom and for what reason? I will also reveal government documents that came to light in Paraguay that support the supposition that Bormann did, in fact, live and die in Paraguay after the war, as many old Nazis and Nazi hunters alike had claimed throughout the 1950s to the 1970s. So could someone have planted Bormann's skull in 1972? Sounds like the plot of a cheap thriller, but the circumstances of its discovery, inexplicable forensic evidence, and the bigger picture suggest it was possible. As I see it, there are three possible scenarios. Scenario one is that Bormann died in Berlin on the 2nd of May 1945, the current official story, and was buried in an unmarked grave by post office workers from the Leerta station under orders from the Red Army, and found by accident in 1972 when construction work disturbed the site. Scenario number two, the West German government found and retrieved Bormann's skull from its grave at Ita, Paraguay, and planted it and Dr. Stumpfegger's skeleton in a grave close to where post office workers had reported burying them in 1945. They did this knowing the area was under redevelopment and helped construction workers accidentally find them. But why? The answer may lie in the poor report of the West German government in its ability to help find fugitive Nazi war criminals. To put it bluntly, from the 1950s to the 1970s, the West German federal government was less than proactive in pushing various South American dictatorships and democracies to arrest and deport wanted Nazis, certainly in comparison to the Polish and Israeli governments, for example. In fact, the West German diplomatic service was still employing ex-Nazis on a massive scale, with many ambassadors and consuls former NSDAP members. The figures speak for themselves. Researchers have found that in the period 1950 to 1973, at the worst case, 77% of senior officials in the West German Justice Ministry were former Nazi Party members. This map from 1962 shows West German ambassadors, those marked with a swastika are former Nazi Party members, while those with a diamond had worked in Hitler's diplomatic service. These men showed a disinclination to hunt out former fellow Nazis. This attitude only changed from the 1970s onwards as the World War II era employees retired from senior positions, their places being taken by the generation untainted by association with Hitler. It's been suggested that many in the West German government and the foreign ministry wanted the whole sordid Nazi past forgotten as the Germans worked hard for readmission to the human race. Therefore, dragging old Nazi monsters out of their South American hidey holes to allow the press another opportunity to bash the Germans over the war and the Holocaust was not desired. So, could the West Germans have pulled off such a stunt? The BND, the West German Intelligence Service, had, ironically, been founded by Major General Reinhard Gehlen, head of the World War II Eastern Front Intelligence Service, Fremde Heere Ost, and his network of agents included many former Gestapo, SD, SS, and Abwehrmen, who went to work for the BND under US protection in the 1950s. The BND was founded in 1956 by Gehlen from an earlier post-war group he called the Org, formed from a number of Abwehr, SS and Gestapo agents. It worked exclusively with the CIA. Gehlen remained in charge of West German intelligence until 1968. A very large number of Nazi war crime suspects found employment with the BND, including many intimately involved with the Holocaust. This was all ignored by the CIA and indeed by the West German government in the Cold War against East Germany and the USSR. It is not beyond the realms of possibility that some BND men were still sympathetic to the old regime and maintained some secret contacts with Nazi networks in South America. The discovery of Martin Bormann's skull in West Berlin in 1972 allowed the West German government to state that Bormann had never escaped justice, as it had maintained all along, and justified its curious inaction for hunting for Bormann in the intervening decades. It also conveniently ended public interest in looking for Nazi war criminals, as the admission that the hunt for Bormann had been nothing more than chasing shadows was sure to end public fascination in the subject, and allow West Germany to put the war once and for all behind it and get on with the European project and the creation of the new Germany. Certainly the discovery of Bormann's remains in 1972 was very convenient for the West Germans, conspiracy or no conspiracy, hence its great haste in declaring Bormann legally dead in 1973 and its rubbishing of any evidence that ran contrary to its official line. Scenario number 3 is linked to number 2. In this scenario, Bormann's remains were planted in West Berlin by shadowy Nazis or their neo-Nazi helpers in order to take the heat off them in South America. Again, the discovery of Bormann's skull and its identification was once more very convenient for the wanted men hiding in various South American nations since the late 1940s. The last important Nazi fugitive had actually never left Berlin, according to the official story. So who cared about the underlings whose names hardly anyone knew? Nazi hunting continued after 1972, of course, particularly the hunt for Dr. Josef Mengele, but never with the same fever pitch of press excitement as during the Bormann years. Neither scenarios, 2 or 3, were impossible. With careful planning and some knowledge, it could have been done. But if it was done, whoever did it made mistakes. Someone ignored the significance of different soil types. Someone tried to tidy up the Stumpfegger's skull, so it conformed to the official story, which was, of course, based entirely upon the unreliable testimony of a Nazi, Hitler Youth leader Arthur Axmann, and Axmann alone. Someone didn't realize that Bormann's dentition could have changed from 1945. Perhaps the operation was done in haste, as it was important to get the Bormann remains found and identified before the ULAP fairground site was redeveloped in West Berlin. It can be suggested that both skulls had evidence of having been worked on. Stumpfegger's skull showed signs of having had a portion excised for some unknown reason. Bormann's skull had a missing lower bridge, which was eventually found 3 months later, after the site had been repeatedly searched. Bormann's skull was encased in a reddish-brown clay that was not found in Berlin. This material was washed off before it could be properly tested. Bormann's jaw showed clear evidence of post-1945 dental work. The bodies were discovered in a position completely different to that noted by Arthur Axmann and in locations some distance from where post office workers testified that they had buried them. Both jaws contained glass fragments from cyanide capsules, but the capsules were different from those used by the SS at the end of the war. These and several other points have never been properly addressed by the German government. So the truth has to be either scenarios 1, 2 or 3. There are no other realistic scenarios to the story of the recovery and identification of Bormann's remains. Now we turn to the evidence that emerged from the Paraguayan archives in the decades after Bormann's skull was found in West Berlin. After the fall of General Alfredo Stroessner's fascist regime in Paraguay, the records of the former administration were searched and catalogued as this awful period in Paraguayan history known as the Terror was addressed. Police records from the Ministry of the Interior reveal that Bormann had indeed been in Asunción, entering from another South American country in 1956. He had then settled at Colonia Hohenau, a German town 350 kilometers south of the capital, living for a long time in the house of a man named Alban Krug. Bormann had also received dental treatment in 1958. At the time, he was suffering from an undiagnosed stomach complaint. This later turned out to be cancer. Bormann died on the 15th of February 1959 in the home of German Werner Jung at Calais General MacArthur, Asunción. This information, which emerged in the 1990s from Paraguayan files, is almost exactly the same as the information I outlined in previous episodes, which came from witnesses in the 1960s and 70s. They are unconnected, but almost exactly the same, which does lend some credence to the idea of Bormann actually being in Paraguay in the 50s. So, Bormann died on the 15th of February 1959, according to official Paraguayan government sources. 2 days later, Bormann was buried by Germans at Ita, 35 kilometers southeast of Asunción. The files reveal that Bormann had come to Paraguay under Stroessner's protection, the dictator employing many old Nazis. These records are genuine and they still exist today, and if they are truthful, make for quite a story. However, they contain no photographs, no fingerprints, and so have very limited use forensically. I'll leave it up to you to decide who may have placed Bormann's skull in the grave in Berlin, and for what reason, or whether indeed you believe the German story that the remains were there since the 8th of May 1945, when the bodies of Bormann and Stumpfegger were interred. Suffice it to say, there are enough pieces of evidence, and enough questions raised by the Bormann skull, and the story of Bormann's death and burial to lead to further investigation. Simply dismissing any questioning of the official narrative as conspiracy theory, in inverted commas, is rather naive, and goes against the whole idea of historical inquiry. There is more to the story of the death of Martin Bormann than meets the eye. Incredibly, after being stored for many years, Bormann's remains were cremated by the Germans in 1999 and scattered in the Kieler Bucht outside of German waters. This means that there is no forensic evidence left that can be re-examined in this case using modern techniques or new technology. You can make of that what you will. Many thanks for watching. Please subscribe and share. And also visit my audiobook channel, War Stories with Mark Felton. You can also help to support both of my channels at PayPal and Patreon. Details in the description box below.